On what is the last day of the month, June 30th, this is Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio. I'm Steve Scully. We're glad you're with us, and here are some of your Wednesday headlines. The House voting to create a select committee dedicated to investigating the January 6th insurrection with support from every Democrat and two congressional Republicans. Former Defense Secretary Don Rumsfeld died earlier today. He was at the Pentagon on the morning of September 11th when America came under attack. He is being praised this evening by former President George W. Bush. In New York, the Manhattan District Attorney's Office informing lawyers of former President Donald Trump that they are considering criminal charges against his family business in connection with fringe benefits the company awarded top executives. The prosecutors had been building a case for months against that top executive, Alan Weisselberg. All of this comes on the same day of a new C-SPAN presidential historian survey, putting the 45th president, Donald Trump, near the bottom of the list of rankings, while Barack Obama has moved up. We'll have the results just ahead. Just some of the stories shaping Washington today here on C-SPAN Radio. We begin on Capitol Hill, where the House moved on creating a select committee dedicated to investigating what happened on January 6th, but it is already turning into a partisan fight over establishing the facts of what occurred inside and outside the U.S. Capitol on that day. Lawmakers voting along party lines 222 to 190. Only two Republicans, Representative Liz Cheney of Wyoming and Adam Kinzinger of Illinois, joining all Democrats to back the committee. House Democrats deciding to move forward with this select committee after legislation to establish an independent bipartisan commission was blocked by Senate Republicans. That happened last month. From the House floor earlier today, here's Speaker Nancy Pelosi.
The newly minority leader of the Senate, Mitch McConnell, asked them to do him a personal favor and vote against the commission. Too many of them chose to do Mitch McConnell a personal favor rather than to perform their patriotic duty. And hence, despite the fact that seven Republican members either voted or said they would vote for the commission, it was defeated. They said, give us another week, give us another week, give us another week, give us another week. Now it's almost, well, it's 4.5 weeks, and we must go forward. It does not appear at this time that we can have a bipartisan commission, outside commission. Hopefully that could still happen. But in the meantime, we will have a select committee. This is not unlike what happened in 2001, at the time of the 9/11 commission. 9/11 happened exactly then, 9/11, 2001. It took almost more than 1 year to get the commission. It was signed into law by the president on November 27, 2002. In the meantime, there was a congressional investigation, which was useful to the commission when they finally were formed. So perhaps we can still hope for that, but we cannot wait for it. To do that, we believe that Congress must, in the spirit of bipartisanship and patriotism, establish this mission. And it will be conducted with dignity, with patriotism, with respect for the American people, so that they can know the truth.
That from House Speaker Nancy Pelosi on today's vote for a select committee. Now, she may appoint Republicans to the panel. Two Republicans, Representative Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger, they've both been critical of the Republican Party's embrace of former President Trump, and they have not ruled out the possibility of serving on the panel if they were asked by the Speaker. But one of the 190 no votes, all from the GOP, freshman Representative Michelle Fishbook, she delivered these remarks prior to the vote.
Democrats are injecting partisanship into the equation, hoping to stretch out an investigation long enough to distract from their abject failure to govern, while the American people are left to suffer the consequences of that failure. While we spend time discussing this partisan committee, American farmers are facing a severe drought, gas prices are going up, inflation is rising, businesses can't find employees, and there's a crisis at the southern border. We need to spend our time finding solutions and helping Americans, not creating partisan commissions to do work that has already been done competently by the U.S. Senate and by law enforcement. Not only would this select committee not prohibit interfering with ongoing law enforcement investigations that are already yielding significant results, it would lack the enforcement powers of those existing investigations. And even worse, Speaker Pelosi would have the ability to handpick the entirety of the committee. If Speaker Pelosi and House Democrats were serious about this, they might have considered acting sooner than 6 months after the fact. The standing committees of this body already have the jurisdiction and the authority to investigate January 6th, and the Speaker could have directed them to open an investigation at any time. But perhaps most important, it is our obligation to the brave men and women of law enforcement who responded to the Capitol and surrounding areas on January 6th. Members of the U.S. Capitol Police, the D.C. Metropolitan Police, the National Guard, and the many other state and federal agencies who assisted in restoring order. We owe it to them to ensure that any investigation we undertake is one that is fair, bipartisan, and honorable. Absent the ulterior motives and partisan politics that so often plague us. Unfortunately, Madam Speaker, HRES 503 falls far short.
Again, that resolution, which passed the vote 222 to 190, that was Minnesota Republican Congresswoman Michelle Fishbook. And again, this headline from thehill.com, the House approving a select panel to probe the attacks on January 6th. And now to Surfside, Florida. Four additional victims have been found dead inside the rubble of that collapsed condo building. The death toll now officially at 16, but expected to go higher. The number of those unaccounted for now stands at 147. The search, the rescue, and the recovery effort continues 24/7, now in its seventh day. At the White House earlier today, Press Secretary Jen Psaki with more on President Biden's visit tomorrow.
Walk us through what the president will be doing tomorrow in Surfside, Florida. Will
Sure.
he actually visit the building site?
Well, I know first there's a lot of questions about this, and as details become finalized and available, we will make them all available to you. So let me outline for you what we have at this point, which is pretty consistent with what I outlined just yesterday. Just one moment. So while the president and first lady, who is joining him on this trip, are in Florida tomorrow, they will be thanking heroic first responders, search and rescue teams, and everyone who's been working tirelessly around the clock. They will also meet with families who have been forced to endure this terrible tragedy. In terms of the logistics and the schedule of the day, we're still finalizing those details. Of course, we hope to have them all nailed down before the end of the day, given this trip is tomorrow. But unfortunately, I don't have many additional specifics at this point.
Clear whether he'll visit the building or just not able to announce it yet?
We're still working out the final components of the trip tomorrow. And as I would note, and the president repeated this to me multiple times yesterday, every component of this is going to be, needs to be coordinated with officials on the ground. There is still an ongoing search and rescue effort on the ground, and we want to ensure we're not doing anything to pull away from those resources.
That from today's White House briefing with Press Secretary Jen Psaki. And joining us on the phone is Senior White House Correspondent for CBS News, Ed O'Keefe. The trip announced yesterday, what's the objective of the President and First Lady?
Well, I think this White House understands that they're uniquely equipped with a president who's pretty good at these kinds of moments, or the comforter-in-chief role that a president occasionally has to play. He has been known to, at funerals, at other memorial events, when he meets somebody on a rope line, to really pour out his soul to them and give them a sense of what it is they're now facing, having dealt with it in the untimely, unexpected death of his young wife and daughter, more recently with the very public death of his son, Beau, before he, or when he was still vice president. He talks frequently about the hope that he has for people, that the thought of somebody who's passed at some point switches from a tear in your eye to a smile on your face. And we can expect that that is his mission tomorrow, is to bring comfort and understanding to these people. Given that there's very little that the federal government really can be doing in response to this, given that it was such a specific incident, besides providing material support to local and state officials. So we're told to expect that he will meet with at least some of the family members of these victims, most of whom, of course, have not yet been found. and likely meet with a barrage of local and state officials as well. I suppose from a political standpoint, the most intriguing meeting could be the one he may or may not have with Florida's Governor Ron DeSantis, who very well could be someone he faces on a ballot in 2024.
And, of course, there are a number of investigations, as you pointed out, on the local and state level, and also the possibility of criminal charges. The Commerce Department also looking into what happened.
Yeah, and, you know, again, given that this was specific to one site and there's not documentation that people who lived in the building and had worked or inspected the building were aware of the problems, certainly there's going to be a rash of lawsuits and other investigations by local and state authorities. To what extent the federal government ultimately gets involved, though, is less clear beyond the role they're already playing through FEMA in helping locally. If anything, I suspect that you may see some legislative or sort of policymaking proposals made after the fact to ensure that this kind of tragedy just doesn't happen again.
We're talking to Ed O'Keefe of CBS News. Let's turn our attention to infrastructure. There have been a series of developments over the last 5 to 6 days. Where do things stand this Wednesday evening, and what's the new timeline for any sort of bipartisan agreement between the White House and Congress?
I don't think we're going to have a good handle on that until after the July 4th period when both the House and Senate are out. I mean, the Senate's out this week, House is out next week, so they're both gone next week. And it's not really until after that that I think we're going to get a good sense of how quickly the Senate might move, whether the House is going to move concurrently or in a similar fashion, and whether this is doable by one or both chambers before an August recess or whether this bleeds into the fall. I stand by what the president had said just last week, that he expected to sign this by the end of the fiscal year, which folks in Washington know is September 30th. But there's a host of other things that would have to get done by then as well. So let's see if they do that and if there's enough time between now and then on a calendar to move these massive pieces of legislation. Because even if it's just the bipartisan deal, it's a big piece of work that has to get through the Senate, has to get through the House. And if Speaker Pelosi continues to insist that this has to begin in the Senate, then that is certainly going to influence the timing and how quickly this moves. And it's going to result in some pent-up ambition and frustration, certainly among House Democrats, who aren't going to be happy that they don't have total control of this, given the dynamics in the Senate and the expectation that the bipartisan and then the Democrat-only bill are able to get through. So we're looking still at several more weeks, if not months, of this. And, you know, that makes for sort of traditional Washington law writing and debate over a significant piece of federal spending or pieces of federal spending. You know, for those that think this is weird, remember, this is kind of the way it always used to be. And it's expected to continue for a while because there really is no urgent deadline tied to this. There's no debt ceiling involved. There's no, you know, fiscal cliff or anything like that. This is just a spending program that they'd like to see completed. And one that, in the belief of the White House, at least has to be done by the end of the fiscal year.
And as you point out, so many different political variables. But as somebody who spent so much time on Capitol Hill as a congressional reporter for The Washington Post, specifically with the Republican leader, Mitch McConnell, in the Senate, will he let this type of deal go through?
Well, I mean, if Democrats can hold on to all of their members and at least 10 Republicans, McConnell's not really going to have much of a choice. And so, you know, at least when it comes to the bipartisan agreement. And I think even based on what he has been doing and saying in the past week by casting doubt on it, you know, if anything, it may have actually bolstered the Republican support for the deal because it forced the White House to clarify the president's statements last week about I would only sign one if both were there, and that whole process argument that went on. You know, we've seen no evidence this week of any wavering Republican support among those that had been supporting it in any significant way. And the travel that the president conducted this week and will continue to conduct in the coming weeks is designed to bolster support for both deals and convince voters that this is something that should happen, which is only going to put pressure on members in both parties to be for the one or the other that they're, you know, in their view, able to vote on. And, you know, some of that travel, frankly, isn't just about holding on to Republican support or building bipartisan support for that bipartisan agreement, but it's going to be to convince Democrats that it's okay to be doing both of these the way that they're currently structured and that they should happen and that Democrats shouldn't have any doubt that both of these would be sufficient pieces of legislation that would address some record-setting federal spending.
We will look for your reporting on the evening news, CBSN and CBSNews.com. Ed O'Keefe, senior White House correspondent, as always, we thank you for being with us.
Great to be with you.
On Wall Street, the Dow gaining 210 points at the closing bell. The S&P rose 5, which, by the way, sets a new record high as the first half of 2021 is wrapped up for the S&P and the NASDAQ, losing 24. During a hearing on Capitol Hill today, Microsoft arguing that the U.S. government has abused the use of gag orders to keep subpoenas and warrants secret in law enforcement investigations. The tech giant is calling for new restrictions on their use. Microsoft's vice president of customer security testifying before a House Judiciary Committee hearing, criticizing the government for what the company views as an abuse of nondisclosure orders. Now, those court orders preventing companies from notifying their customers when the Justice Department is looking for customer account information. Here is Microsoft Vice President Tom Burt.
While the recent news about secret investigations is shocking, most shocking is just how routine secrecy orders have become when law enforcement targets an American's email, text messages, or other sensitive data stored in the cloud. This abuse is not new. It is also not unique to one administration and is not limited to investigations targeting the media and Congress. Secrecy orders are too often used for routine investigations based on a cursory assertion that the government has met a statutory burden. The Justice Department's own template does not even require facts justifying the need for secrecy. Instead, the template merely asserts that any disclosure would seriously jeopardize the investigation for a variety of boilerplate reasons. It's no surprise, then, that throughout the Obama, Trump, and Biden administrations, up to a third of all legal demands we receive from federal law enforcement include secrecy orders, up to 3,500 in just 1 year. And these are just the demands on Microsoft. Add the demands likely served on Facebook, Apple, Google, Twitter, and others, and you get a frightening sense of the mountain of secrecy orders used by federal law enforcement in recent years. As has been pointed out, this is very different than investigations conducted before the advent of cloud computing. If law enforcement wanted to get access to data on a computer or a network in your home or your office, they would have to obtain and serve a warrant in order to enter your premise and collect evidence. If law enforcement wanted to secretly search your physical office, it had to meet the heightened standards required to get a so-called sneak and peek warrant. However, today, if law enforcement wants to secretly search your virtual office in the cloud, they just serve a boilerplate warrant and secrecy order on your cloud provider that prevents notice to you.
That observation from Tom Burt. He serves as the Vice President of Customer Security for Microsoft, a congressional hearing that we covered. It's available on our website at cspan.org. Now, the issue has come to Capitol Hill's attention after a number of disclosures where the Justice Department, including under President Trump, sought information stored by tech companies for politically sensitive investigations and preventing the companies from discussing the data collection with their customers. Those individuals have ranged from journalists, including at CNN and The Washington Post, to members of Congress and even a former White House counsel, Don McGahn. All of this comes on the same week that Fox News host Tucker Carlson making a claim that the NSA is spying on him and planning to leak his communications in a bid to take him off the air. Florida Congressman Matt Gaetz, facing a separate investigation for his own personal conduct, made these comments.
When I saw the reports about members of Congress offices being targeted, Mr. Swalwell, Mr. Schiff, I was the first and the only Republican to say that that was improper. And more of my colleagues should join me. It was easy to believe that the Department of Justice would do that to the Democrats because they threatened to do it to us. Mr. Chairman, I seek unanimous consent to enter into the record Fox News publication from September 27, 2018, Rosenstein launched hostile attack in May against Republicans over Russia records.
Without objection.
Rosenstein threatened Kash Patel, who was a member of Republican staff, with criminal process if he did not bend to what Mr. Rosenstein wanted at the time. So it's not hard to believe. The most watched cable news host has been stating for the last several nights that the NSA has been monitoring his communications. And amazingly, the NSA has issued a statement that is so couched, it is functionally an admission. Let's review. The NSA says, on June 28, 2021, Tucker Carlson alleged that the National Security Agency has been, quote, monitoring our electronic communications and is planning to leak them in an attempt to take this show off the air, close quote. This allegation is untrue. But which allegation? The statement continues. Tucker Carlson has never been an intelligence target of the agency, and the NSA has never had any plans to try to take his program off the air. And the statement continues. But what's interesting is that there is no denial that they were monitoring Tucker Carlson, even if he wasn't the target. We saw this exact playbook with Carter Page and Donald Trump, where in order to try to assess information from one person, the intelligence community will utilize authorities to go after someone else to try to ensnare their true target. I think that's why they were going after Democrat staff, to try to get to Schiff and Swalwell. I think it's the reason they were going after Republican staff, perhaps to target Mr. Nunes or others. I think it's why they were going after Carter Page to get to Trump. And I think that there was probably somebody in Tucker Carlson's orbit that NSA was monitoring, and there's no denial that they caught up Tucker Carlson in that monitoring. And by the way, there's also no denial that there was a plan to leak the information to try to, in some way, embarrass Tucker Carlson. The only denial is that they weren't expressly trying to get his show off the air.
Those comments from Matt Gaetz, Florida Republican congressman. He read part of that NSA statement refuting claims by Tucker Carlson that read that the allegations are untrue. The NSA added, quote, "The NSA has a foreign intelligence mission. We may not target a U.S. citizen without a court order that explicitly authorizes the targeting." Former Defense Secretary Don Rumsfeld died earlier today. His family with this announcement, quote, "It is with deep sadness that we share the news of the passing of Donald Rumsfeld, an American statesman and devoted husband, father, grandfather, and great-grandfather. At the age of 88, he was surrounded by family in his beloved New Mexico home," read the statement. Don Rumsfeld served in the Republican administrations of Presidents Gerald Ford and George W. Bush. He oversaw the Pentagon's response to the terrorist attacks on September 11th of 2001. He also served in the House of Representatives. And back in 2011, he sat down with C-SPAN's founder Brian Lamb on Q&A to talk about his new book, Known and Unknown. Here is part of that conversation.
I want to run the opening to Nightline. You've worked for 4 years. All of a sudden, the book goes into the hands of the media.
Yeah.
And all this is the introduction, and I want to get your reaction.
It must be bad, or you wouldn't want to run.
No, it's not. Have you seen this?
I have not.
Okay, let's run it and get your reaction.
Okay.
Tonight on Nightline, world exclusive, Diane Sawyer goes head-to-head with Donald Rumsfeld in a TV first. The former Secretary of Defense opens up as never before. The controversies, the wars, the WMDs, and the big question, what did he get wrong? Plus, the man whose public face has been stony defiance gets emotional for the first time about his private trials at home during his tenure at the Pentagon. An eye-opening, surprising, revelatory interview starts right now.
From the global resources of ABC News, with Terry Moran, Cynthia McFadden, and Bill Weir in New York City, this is Nightline, February 7th, 2011.
So what's your reaction to the Don Rumsfeld book?
Well, I think I have seen that, or at least parts of that. You mean, I know what I think about the book. I like it.
No, but I mean the way it's treated.
The way it's treated?
The trumpet's blowing. And
it sounds like it's hype. I guess they want people to watch their television show is why they do it that way. That's not, the book has been characterized quite differently by other people as a very serious historical book that people interested in history will read.
What's your reaction to in two cases they show you breaking down on camera? What's your reaction to seeing that?
Well, you know, I wish, I don't know what my reaction is. It happened that my wife was terribly sick and almost died at one point, and my dad had Alzheimer's, and it's something that's hard to talk about or think about, and those are things that I'm not normally discussing, but she asked the questions and I answered them as best I could.
That from a 2011 interview with Don Rumsfeld conducted by C-SPAN's Brian Lamb. You can check it out at cspan.org. Don Rumsfeld served as the youngest and the oldest defense secretary during the Ford and later the George W. Bush administration. Former President Bush issuing the statement that reads in part, quote, "On the morning of September 11, 2001, Donald Rumsfeld ran to the fire at the Pentagon to assist the wounded and ensure the safety of survivors. For the next 5 years, he was in steady service as a wartime Secretary of Defense, a duty he carried out with strength, skill, and honor. In a busy and purposeful life, Don Rumsfeld was a naval officer, a member of Congress, a distinguished cabinet official in several administrations, a respected business leader. Don Rumsfeld died earlier today. He was 88 years old. You're listening to Washington Today. And welcome back to Washington Today for this Wednesday with producer Shannon Rice. South Dakota is now the last of the 50 states to confirm the presence of the highly contagious Delta variant. The Delta variant now accounts for 26% of new cases in the U.S., that according to the CDC. And new rankings for America's presidents. A C-SPAN survey out earlier today. We'll have the details just ahead. Meanwhile, former President Donald Trump traveling to Texas, touring parts of the U.S.-Mexico border, where Governor Greg Abbott has vowed to build a border wall. It comes as Republicans continue to criticize President Biden and his administration for an increase in apprehensions along the border. There were more than 180,000 apprehensions just last month, and 40% of those were turned back that had previously crossed into the U.S., and that compares to fewer than 25,000 in late 2020 during the final month of the Trump administration. That data from the U.S. Customs and Border Protection Office and from McAllen, Texas, this with the former president.
Well, Governor, thank you very much. It was an honor to endorse you and strongly endorse you, highest and best endorsement. And I did notice your poll numbers are through the roof, and I'm very happy. And you've done a great job and worked. Really honored to be with you and with Dan and with Ken. We've had a great team. And the people in this room, every one of us is a friend of mine. In one form or another, we dealt with each other for a period of 4 years. And we brought the border to a level that it has never been. Mark, you have been incredible. Tom Holman has been unbelievable. Nobody knows it like Tom. Mm-hmm. And I have to say, Chad, you did a great job. You stepped up. You came in and you stepped up and you did a great job. And we appreciate it. And you're still doing a great job. But the border has never been this way. It went from the best border we've ever had in the history of our country. Not 20 years. You know, they like to say over a 22-year period. No, it's the best ever by far. It took 2.5 years to start the wall because we were sued by everybody. And then and largely by the Democrats in Congress, by the way. And now, by the way, they're doing a disinformation campaign. They're saying that the unsafe border is your fault. You believe this? Because they're getting killed with the border. So now they're saying, oh, we got a problem. So let's blame the sheriffs. Let's blame the governors. Let's blame everybody else but them. They're also saying it with defund the police. They came out with a term, defund the police. And they're, you know, it's well documented, that's for sure. Just look at AOC and look at Omar. How's she doing? How's her country doing, by the way? And they're telling us how to run our country right now. How are they doing? And now they're saying, no, no, it was them, us, that wanted to defund. It's like Russia, Russia, Russia. Everyone said, Russia, Russia, Russia. I said, what's that all about? And then they said, oh, you were very friendly. Well, that's been proven to be false, not only false. It was them that were associated with Russia.
From Texas earlier today, and in ABC's The Note, there is this from political director Rick Klein, quote, Texas Governor Greg Abbott is only the latest potential GOP presidential candidate to see value in spiritual, if not physical, proximity to former President Trump. Rick Klein joining us on the phone here in Washington. First, to your point from The Note this morning and to what unfolded today, what was this all about?
This was really a remarkable political show. You had the former president there in some reflected glow of the current governor of Texas, who is himself a potential presidential candidate. And of course, Abbott is saying that he wants to himself try to finish the signature project of that former president. Remarkable on so many levels, not least of which the fact that President Trump continues to peddle election-related lies and all kinds of falsehoods about the Biden administration as well. But it really tells you how the Republican Party is developing in this post-Trump era, that he is attracting people like Abbott and many other presidential contenders. They want to be as close as possible, at least for now, to Donald Trump.
And in the last week, a number of other Republican governors in Florida, Ron DeSantis, in South Dakota, Governor Kristi Noem, two names also mentioned in 2024, sending National Guard troops to the border. What's that all about?
Yeah, I mean, you'll notice that South Dakota and Florida are really nowhere near the U.S.-Mexico border. But DeSantis just last week said 50 police officers from Florida would be headed there. And Governor Noem of South Dakota said 50 National Guardsmen that are based in South Dakota would be headed to the border as well. Not clear exactly what they're doing. Not clear also, in some cases, who's financing it. In the case of South Dakota, it appears to be a private financer, a wealthy businessman who's essentially bankrolling that deployment. But it suggests that the border issue is a strong one for Republicans, and it suggests that the sense of crisis that that many on the in the border region and the Republican Party feel is real around the U.S.-Mexico border is a potent enough issue that that states that really have almost nothing to do with the border are sending resources that way.
But clearly, a number of 2024 aspirants, including former U.N. Ambassador Nikki Haley, first very critical of the President Trump at the time after January 6th, as you point out, quote, softening her criticism.
Fascinating to me. I mean, Ambassador Haley was among the most critical prominent voices in the Republican Party, really felt like she was separating herself from President Trump after January 6th. But since that time, she's softened her critiques, and she's even saying now explicitly that if he runs for president, she will not, just drawing that out. And I think that's the going speculation for most of the people that we're talking about here, is that if President Trump chooses to give it another go, it's not that he'll have a clear field, but most of the people that would occupy a similar ideological lane, a Trumpist lane, aren't going to try to go against the big guy. I think there will be other candidates, certainly, mostly of the never-Trump variety in the Republican Party. But Trump's got the party to himself, at least for now.
We're talking with Rick Klein. He is the political director for ABC News, and one of the looming issues could be resolved tomorrow as the Trump Organization facing some criminal charges. What are you looking for?
I think the extent to which any charges are documented and may extend beyond any initial action. Our reporters who've been on this have suggested there could be charges against the Trump Organization's chief financial officer or the Trump Organization and or the Trump Organization itself, although not other individuals and not the former president. But if the charges are fairly limited and talking about improper accounting practices for taxation purposes, of fringe benefits, it may be an attempt to further investigation and just get the charges out that they can initially. So I think any hints about how far and wide and deep an investigation may go will be interesting from the perspective of the state and local prosecutors who are pursuing these charges.
And Rick Klein, do you have a sense one day before any potential charges are filed where this puts former President Trump, either in terms of any criminal court issues or politically?
Well, I think in terms of the criminal courts, he has not been charged with anything. There are no charges that we're aware of that are actively pending. But the organization, of course, is his, and it's very closely tied to his own actions. And it would suggest that there are still issues unresolved that might implicate the former president. As for the politics, there are those who believe former President Trump is going to run for re-election, in part because of the scrutiny that he faces, that it might be the best avenue for him to avoid legal scrutiny because it may be the prosecutors are reticent to go after someone who's still active in politics. So it raises an interesting question. Of course, we remember in the wake of January 6th and the second impeachment of President Trump, there was an attempt to convict him that could have led to disqualification from holding office. Of course, the conviction didn't happen, so there was never a discussion over that disqualification part of it. So he remains eligible to run for president. In fact, there's some of his supporters who will wrongly and wildly claim that the only reason he might be ineligible is that he's still currently the president. Of course, that's just a nutty conspiracy theory. But the bottom line is he is still a very popular figure among much of the Republican base. It's become the Trump base in large part. There's no question in my mind that if he were to run again, he'd be the overwhelming favorite for the Republican nomination in 2024, whatever prosecutors decide to bring against him.
More details available at abcnews.com and every morning, The Note with Rick Klein, political director. Thank you for being with us.
My pleasure, Steve. Thank you.
In other news, comedian Bill Cosby back home this evening after his conviction for sexual assault was overturned by a Pennsylvania appeals court earlier today. The Washington Post writing the following, quote, "It was a dramatic reversal in a case that represented the first high-profile sexual assault trial to unfold in the aftermath of the Me Too movement. Mr. Cosby had served 3 years of a 3 to 10 year prison sentence at a maximum security facility outside of Philadelphia when the 7-member Pennsylvania Supreme Court ruled that Mr. Cosby, who, by the way, is 83 years old, had been denied a fair trial back in 2018. One of his lawyers on the appeal, Brian Perry, saying that his client was released from prison shortly after 2 o'clock this afternoon and heading home to his suburban Philadelphia house. Now, the ruling upended the legal case against Bill Cosby brought on by prosecutors in Pennsylvania. It began with his arrest back in 2015 on charges of drugging and sexually assaulting a woman at his home in the Philadelphia suburbs 11 years earlier. At the end of the trial in April of 2018, the jury convicted Bill Cosby, who for years had brightened America's living rooms as a beloved entertainer and a father figure. More details on the story at WashingtonPost.com and more reaction tonight. Felicia Rashad, who appeared as Bill Cosby's wife in the hit television series The Cosby Show, praising the decision on Twitter, saying, quote, "Finally, a terrible wrong is being righted. A miscarriage of justice is corrected." But one of those allegedly raped by Bill Cosby back in 1984, upset over the decision to overturn his sexual assault conviction, Beth Ferrier telling the New York Post, quote, "The decision was BS driven by money and power." Weather experts say that when one side of the country is dealing with hot weather, it tends to be relatively cool on the opposite end. Well, certainly not this week. Heat domes situated over the Pacific Northwest and here in the Northeast causing record high temperatures. In Boston, for example, the high today of 99 degrees. In Newark, New Jersey, 102 degrees. And the concern out west in Arizona, Nevada, and California, what could be a record number of forest fires in the weeks and months ahead. The president addressing the issue today, he was preparing for a series of meetings as the summer drought season gets underway. The president holding a virtual meeting with governors of western states designed to show that the White House is treating wildfires, which have grown by at least 100 incidents each year since 2015, as no less a national emergency than hurricanes or other natural disasters. More from the White House.
In fact, the threat of western wildfires this year is as severe as it's ever been. And I wanted to convene this group of governors, of western state governors, key members of my cabinet, FEMA leadership, and the leadership from utility industries, and senior members of our White House team to make sure we're doing everything, and I mean this sincerely, we're doing everything possible to help you prepare for what's coming. And some is already there. The truth is, we're playing catch-up. This is an area that has been under-resourced, but that's going to change if we have anything to do with it. We can't cut corners when it comes to managing our wildfires or supporting our firefighters. And this briefing is going to be an annual event to make sure we're focusing on preventing fires, the fire threats in the first place, as well as responding when they arise. But right now, we have to act and act fast. We're late in the game here. We're remembering the horrific scenes from last year. Orange skies that looked like end of days, smoke and ash that made the air dangerous to breathe, more than 10 million acres burned, billions of dollars in economic damage, families that lost their homes and everything they own, and too many lost lives. And this year, there could be even tougher based on the weather patterns.
And that with President Biden during a virtual event hosted at the White House and joining the conversation, California Governor Gavin Newsom.
It goes without saying, in California, we were engaged in a relationship with the federal government vis-a-vis the vice president's question. It was more like a sparring partners, not working partners. So we have an opportunity here to turn the page on the finger pointing and the rhetoric. We were debating raking policies, literally debating raking policies in this country in the last few years. But our eyes are wide open. By the way, I'm here in your forest, our forest, federal forest in Klamath and Siskiyou County, two of the largest wildfires that we've had year to date in this region. We were up here yesterday. Thank you, Mr. President. I didn't have to make a call to you to get the FMAG approved yesterday up here in Siskiyou County for the largest of the wildfires, the lava fire, which is a few miles away from me. But look, the hots are getting hotter. The dries are getting drier. The smash mouth realities of climate change are here, and they're here decades ahead of when we had anticipated. So across the board, we have to disabuse ourselves of the old timelines and the old frames of engagement. I mean, the seriousness of this cannot be underscored. We had last year a heat dome over the west coast of the United States, not dissimilar to the one we're experiencing north of where I am, and Governor Brown and Inslee have experienced most acutely. But that led to 12,000 lightning strikes in 24 hours and five of the most destructive wildfires, five of the six largest in our history, concurrently in last year's wildfire season. We were burning up. We were choking up. We haven't just heated up.
In addition to California Governor Newsom, the White House meeting virtually with governors from Nevada, Utah, Wyoming, and other western states as the country continues to grapple with record heat and the real prospect of a record number of wildfires, especially out west. Susan Page of USA Today is reporting on a new survey conducted by C-SPAN that looks at America's presidents. She writes the following, quote, Donald Trump is ranked near the bottom of all U.S. presidents by a group of historians, getting the lowest grade for leadership of any commander-in-chief who has served in the White House for the past 150 years. You can read her full story at usatoday.com. 142 historians, teachers, and presidential experts participating in this C-SPAN survey, looking at 10 individual leadership characteristics, including public persuasion, moral authority, relations with Congress, and setting an agenda. Our colleague Rachel Katz had a leading role in this fourth C-SPAN survey. We spoke with her earlier today.
So this was former President Trump's first time in our survey, and the historians this year ranked him at number 41. Last time was President Obama's first time in the survey, and he came in at number 12, and this year has jumped up two spots, landing him in the top 10, right at number 10. And then since 2000, President Grant has had one of the largest moves, moving up 13 points.
There are 10 leadership characteristics, among them public persuasion, crisis leadership, and performance within the context of the times of their presidency. Can you explain a little?
Yeah, so with each of the 10 leadership characteristics, they've remained the same through all four surveys, and we purposely don't give a definition to the characteristics. We let the historians define them for themselves. And I think the three that you listed, the crisis leadership and performance within the context of the times, can change a lot over time as you're thinking back and as we are learning more about each of the timeframes that these people were president. It changes your perspective a little bit. And we reach out, we're always increasing the number of historians who are participating to increase the numbers and to also get a diversity of viewpoints. And I think that's what helps change some of these rankings.
In this cycle, 142 historians, professors, and observers of the presidency, how are they selected?
So we look at C-SPAN's databases of people who have been on our programming. We look at the people who have participated in the survey before. We do research in the field. Who are the new professors of American history? Who is following the presidency? And we put that all together and reach out to a good number of people and see who is interested in participating each year. And this year, we were lucky enough to get an over 50% increase from last year to from last cycle to 142.
We're talking to Rachel Katz here at C-SPAN. The survey itself, a lot of data, a lot of information to go through. How can our listeners navigate through that?
They go to cspan.org/presidentsurvey2021. They'll be able to see the full ranking of all of the presidents, as well as within each leadership category. They'll see the full list of 142 historians and observers of the presidency who participated. They can see a little bit about our methodology, our four survey advisors, and they can see what we're calling a gallery of insights, which are 34 graphics that are key takeaways from the survey that can be shared on social media.
One of our colleagues here at C-SPAN, congratulations on the survey and the great work. We appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Steve.
And this programming reminder, four of the leading historians who took a leading role in this survey, author and historian Richard Norton Smith, professor and author Doug Brinkley, Edna Medford, and Amity Schles, the four will be joining us Sunday morning, 8 o'clock Eastern Time, on C-SPAN's Washington Journal for a two-hour program to take your calls, your comments, and your questions on this fourth C-SPAN survey on the American presidents. Again, Richard Norton Smith, Doug Brinkley, Edna Medford, and Amity Schles, Sunday morning, 8 o'clock Eastern Time, here on C-SPAN Radio, live on C-SPAN Television. And, of course, all of our coverage available online anytime at cspan.org. This program, Washington Today, it's available as a podcast. Be sure to listen and follow wherever you get your favorite podcast. I'm Steve Scully, hoping you enjoy the rest of your Wednesday evening.